So I'm Don Johnson. Been sitting with Gil here for about 10 years. And I'm going to talk tonight about a topic that came up for me when I was sitting a retreat last month. And every day during the retreat, we would chant the part of the Satipatthana Sutta in... farther down? Oh, center. Okay. Great. Is this better? So the Mahasatipatthana Sutta? Okay. And that's what you have copies of here. English, Pali in the middle, and then Vietnamese in the side. We'll skip the Vietnamese. But I thought I'd start by reading this section in English, and then we'll try it together in Pali. Because I thought that might be kind of fun. So, this is the only way, bhikkhus, for the purification of beings, for the overcoming of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of pain and grief, for reaching the noble path, for the realization of nibbana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness. What are the four? In this teaching, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu dwells contemplating the body, in the body, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, removing covetousness and grief in the world. A bhikkhu dwells contemplating the feeling in the feelings, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, removing covetousness and grief in the world. A bhikkhu dwells contemplating the consciousness in the consciousness, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, removing covetousness and grief in the world. A bhikkhu dwells contemplating the Dhamma in the Dhammas, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, removing covetousness and grief in the world. So it's pretty repetitious, but this is kind of like the Buddha's catechism, I think. Like, he taught for 45 years, wandering around India, never staying in the same place for more than 3 or 4 months at a time. He's probably gave this thing thousands of times. People memorized it. So, and it's kind of the core of the Buddhist teachings as we teach them here in this center. One of these phrases jumped out at me. I said, I have to know more about that. But I thought first, just for variety, we'd try this in Pali. And a little bit about Pali pronunciation, the makron, the bar over the A, it doesn't make it an A, it makes it an A, a long A. C's are pronounced like CH's. TH's are pronounced like th, not like thing, but like tub, something like that. And if the monks you're with are Burmese, V's are pronounced like W's. Okay, so I was with Burmese monks, so we'll pronounce them like W's tonight. And the tiltas over the N are pronounced like in Spanish. And the little dots and all that you can probably forget about. Okay, at least I can. So I'm going to try it once, and then we'll try it together, just for kicks. Eko yano ayam bikawe mago, satanam visudhya, soko pare devanam, samatika maya, dukkha domanasanam, atanga maya, nyayasa adigamaya, nibanasa sachikiriyaya, yad idam chitaro satipatthana. Katame chitaro, ida bikawe bhikkhu, kaye kaya nupase viharati, atapi sampajano satima, viniya loke abija domanasam. Vedanasu vedanupase viharati, atapi sampajano satima, viniya loke abija domanasam. Chite chitanupase viharati, atapi sampajano satima, viniya loke abija domanasam. Damesu damanupase viharati, atapi sampajano satima, viniya loke abija domanasam. So let's just try this. I'll try one line, and if you feel like it, try that line after me. Otherwise, you just sit back and listen to us all stumble with it. Ekayano ayam bikawe mago. maybe we should try a word at a time. Let's just try a couple of these phrases. Ekayano. Ayam. Bikawe. Mago. Ekayano. Ayam. Bikawe. Mago. Okay. That's an important one. And then let's just zip down here to the middle. Atapi Sampajano Satima. Okay. Those are a couple of the ones I wanted to talk about. Anyway, we won't have to try this. I won't drag you through the pronunciation of this whole thing. The reason I asked that we try the Atapi Sampajano Satima together is because that's the one that kind of jumped out at me. I said, gee, you know, are they the Sampajano and Satima, this clearly comprehending and mindful? What's the difference between them? I know that the Buddha's repeating a lot here. Is there some reason that he's using two different words for the same concept, or is there something else going on? So I wanted to talk a little bit about that tonight and tell you about background about some of the words in here. First, there's bhikkhu. So we talked about bhikkhu. Is strictly, it means a male monastic, a monk who is no longer a novice but has had the higher ordination. It's kind of like, you know, really into it. But in this sutta here, it's used in the sense of anybody who's really, really trying to practice. Man, woman, lay, ordained. Kind of like we sometimes use yogi. So think of it in that sense. We're all included. Those of us who have been here for a long time, those of us that are here for the first time, are all included in this bhikkhu. The phrase that it starts off with, ekayano mago, the only way, that can be kind of troublesome for people. Depending on how you grew up, if what your religious environment was, if there was a religious exclusivism and that has bothered you in some way, or if you're looking around at what's going on in the world today and seeing the way that one religion is squaring off against another, you might be kind of bothered by this. And there's no doubt that the Buddha thought that, you know, he was onto something that other people didn't have, and that's why his followers followed him for that reason. But I haven't heard it described in that sense, that downgrading other practices. In fact, on this when I was on this retreat, the head monk there took pains to explain how he interpreted it. At first, it was one way. It's the only way. It means not morality, not contemplation on loving kindness, or not concentration practices or jhana. But those are all supporting practices we teach and practice in this center and this tradition. But those aren't what gets you to liberation. Those aren't what gets you to the final goal for the Buddha. That was the technique taught in this sutta here, this mindfulness. In that sense, it's an only way. And it's an only way in the sense that it's only leading to liberation. It's not for the purpose of feeling good or doing good. Those can come, but those are byproducts of the path. The real reason for this isn't for good works or good vibes. It's for liberation from suffering. And then there's another sense in which it's the only way. It's after a certain stage, after you've wrestled with some of the things we'll talk about tonight, it's said you will get to the point where you know these things in your bones. And from that point onward, there's no slipping back. You know, what's called a stream enterer, and you'll just progress over this lifetime or the next few lifetimes to the final goal. There's also satipatthana, and that's the title of this sutta, and it's a compound word, and it's usually rendered as foundations of mindfulness. But I kind of like what this book said about it. To bump into this book, The Heart of Buddhist Meditation by Nayana Panika. It's really nice. And basically he said it's a compound word. Sati is mindfulness. And in the sense, in a couple of senses, but in the sense of moment-to-moment attention of what's going on. And we use that word rather than awareness or something, because awareness has kind of become a devalued word. It can mean, like, were you aware that the 49ers are in the playoffs? Yeah, yeah. Or not in the playoffs or whatever. But mindfulness has a certain, you know, we kind of use it here to mean a certain, you know, a pointedness of awareness, a certain little extra little effort to it. And patana actually comes from possibly from the verb meaning to place near or put near yourself. So satipatthana means putting your mindfulness near yourself, which I think is kind of a little more poetic than the four foundations of mindfulness. So I like to, you can talk about this as the presence of mindfulness or the discourse on arousing mindfulness, or the way I was thinking about it this afternoon is the sutta on keeping your mindfulness handy. Please. Yeah, okay, right. That's the one up in the top, yeah. And it's a... And then there's the phrase, atapi sampajano satima. And that's where I said, oh, what's going on here? Sati, as we just described, is mindfulness. And when I suggested at the beginning that we think about just pay attention to your breath, be mindful to it coming in and out, without telling stories about it or wondering what's next, whatever... That's kind of the rudiments of mindfulness. Ardent is, in the sense, it means balanced effort. Yeah, not just slacking off, sitting back, wondering if it's going to get any better. Yeah, it's not gritting your teeth and huffing and puffing either. There's a balanced effort, like tuning a guitar or something. You want to get the strings just right so that you can do the practice. And there's a skill to actually figuring out, to balancing that. And that's not something you're expected to get right and never do again. It's kind of like if you're singing, you have to, I couldn't tell, I'm not a singer, but I imagine you have to pay attention so that each note you sing is on key. And there's always a little bit of effort put into that. And it's the same with your mindfulness. Breath to breath, just paying attention. Am I trying too hard? Am I slacking off? And sampajana, it's usually translated as clarity of consciousness or clear comprehension. So what's the difference between that, sati and sampajana, between clear comprehension and mindfulness? And that was the question I had, and that's what I want to talk about tonight. And in this sutta, it's sati is kind of mindfulness on the pillow, and sampajana is mindfulness on the job, or out in the world. And while many times people just say sati, they won't make that distinction. But for the purposes of the sutta, I wanted to talk about how the sutta differentiates between them, not so that we have to walk around making that difference, but so that we get apprised of and can appreciate the range of application of this concept. So Nyanaponika here says the term clear comprehension should be understood to mean that to the clarity of bare mindfulness is added the full comprehension of purpose and actuality. It's a mouthful. So here's a German writing in English, so that's why it sounds like this. The term clear comprehension should be understood to mean that the clarity of bare mindfulness is added, that to the clarity of bare mindfulness is added the full comprehension of purpose and actuality. So we'll come back to that later. But sati, sometimes also just called bare attention. And the Buddha in the four foundations of mindfulness asked us to pay attention to four classes of things: the body, feelings, thoughts, and the contents of our mind. So the body is primarily our breath, or in walking meditation, walking back and forth. So we followed our breath in and out. We may have felt pressure, movement when we did that. Feelings in the sense of sensations. Gee, this knee is killing me. Oh, pain, pain, pain. Pay attention to that. That's not bad mindfulness. It's, oh, I should be paying attention to the breath. No, that's just fine. If the pain is uppermost, pay attention to the pain. Thoughts, if something comes along, says, I thought he said 30 minutes. This has to have been 50 minutes. Thinking, thinking, thinking. Again, that's not a failure of mindfulness. That's just mindfulness going to something else. The thought has come foremost. If you said, I don't think this is going to work at all, that's doubt, doubt, doubt. That's part of the contents of mind. That's doubt, doubt. Even your doubt can become an object of meditation. So that's what the Buddha was laying out here. All of these things can become objects of meditation. And the sense in which sati means bare attention is that we're paying attention to these things in their most primitive or atomic manifestations without stories or elaborations or associations. So, for example, here's what the Buddha says about this in another sutta, not in this one. He says, in what is seen, there should be only the seen. In what is heard, only the heard. In what is sensed, only the sensed. In what is thought, only the thought. So what does that mean? So I'll give an example about this. At my house, we have hummingbirds. And they're just great. They hang around the fuchsias, and they go, you can hear them when they go, vroom. And they, when they chirp, they go, chirp, chirp. And they have a peculiar little chirp that I can't replicate. And we got out a field guide, and we know that they're Anna's hummingbirds. They're not red ruby-throated hummingbirds. They're Anna's hummingbirds. And we know something about the range of them and the fact that they're on the coast of California and all of that. And we know that they like red flowers. So, but if I'm meditating and I hear vroom or chirp, 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 I try to say what I'm noting, hearing, hearing. Now, why am I doing that? It's because if I could say, oh, an Anna's hummingbird down at the fuchsias. That's not bare attention. That's not mindfulness. That is vroom or chirp, chirp, chirp. Piled many times, one on top of another, with pictures, mental associations, emotional. Joy. I'm happy to have the hummingbirds. You know, all of these things. So we try and move back as close as we can to the barest, most primitive, most atomic thing, in this case, hearing, hearing. So when we're breathing, that's the first thing we start off with. The Buddha asked us to think about, and our teachers today will ask us to think about just feelings of pressure or movement, whatever. If we want to, for the purpose of keeping our minds on them, we can say rising, falling, or in, out, and that's called noting. But that's different than telling a story about it. That's like a whisper, 5% in the back of the mind, just as an aid to keep us on the pressure or the movement. Don't let the words come to the front and become a mantra. Then you're going to say in, out, in, out, in, out, and that's not mindfulness. Then you're thinking about the words. The words are there as an aid. If they drop away entirely, that's fine. If, for example, but things will change. If the breath gets really quiet and you can't feel it anymore, it's okay to think about touching and touching, sitting. Just thinking about your sit bones and the cushion and your posture. Touching, sitting, touching, sitting. Things will change, but whatever's there, we just pay attention to it in the most atomic way. And the reason the Buddha asked us to look at these things is because as we look at them this way, without the stories, without all this other stuff, we can pay attention to what's going on. First thing we're going to find out is how fast things change. We're with the breath for 2 seconds, 3 seconds, and then bam, we're off thinking about the utility bill or something like that. Thinking. That's okay. Thinking. But we'll see as we quiet down how fast things change back and forth. But we have a chance to stay with the basic thoughts. We'll also notice that things are, in a sense, unsatisfactory. They, my knee hurts. Or, that was really nice until it stopped. That's unsatisfactory, too. And then we can look at it and we can kind of doubt that, gee, is there really anybody driving this show? Or do things just kind of happen? You get to explore that one for yourself. But by doing this time and time again, we gain two things. We gain the skill at looking at these things without the stories and the emotional overlays and the associations and the fears and everything. And we gain the inclination. So this is kind of like training wheels. We're practicing things with our training wheels on, because at some time, when we're out in the real world or when things are going rough, it'll make it just that much easier to come back to it. We may find that our knees are just really bothering us. I call it the burning bone sensation. Like, you're sure that your bones are glowing red. If you only opened up your eyes, you'd be able to see them through the flesh. But if you stick with it, you'll get to see that, oh no, it changes. It moves around and it ripples and everything. And if you hang with it a little bit longer, you get to see that pain wasn't what you thought it was. It might look like it's somebody else's pain. It's like you're very so intimately associated with it that it, and strangely, it kind of loses some of its power. You may get to the point where, you will, if you stick with it, you get to the point and you say, you know what really hurts is wanting it to stop, is not wanting it this way. I can handle what's going on in the legs, but what really bothers me is the fact that I want it to be different. You get to see that for yourself too. But if you're sitting there thinking, gee, when's that guy going to ring the bell? You're never going to get to that point. So that's where we go back to the most fundamental, the most primitive thing, and pay attention to that, because it's these other things that keep on dragging us around and keep us from seeing what's really there. The fact that, yeah, I can handle that. That's cool. The pain changes. Maybe it's even interesting. And same for thoughts. Things will come along. And if something comes up and the utility bill. I mentioned the utility bill. And you say, oh, gosh, it's late. They're going to cut it off. Oh, what a klutz I am for not doing this. Oh, wait a second. That was a thought. The part about being a klutz or about, it was completely optional. The part about them cutting it off can wait 20 minutes until you stand up. All those things you can push away. But if you dive straight into the full-blown thought with all its associations, you won't get there. You won't get to push all those things away. So it was kind of like this open window. There's a little sliver, slice of time at the beginning of all of these things where we see things without all the fears and associations and the hopes and the stories and everything we've practiced millions of times since we were 2 years old or whenever it was. We get to see things and we say, oh, I have a choice about this, don't I? I don't have to do it that way. And that's very valuable. In addition to the things that the Buddha said that he asked us to pay attention to, how fast things change and all that, we can use this in our daily lives for actually handling stuff that comes up. For example, I had a really nasty experience a week or so ago. And I was just, as a business thing that just went completely upside down and sideways, and I felt totally betrayed. I couldn't understand what was going on. I was enraged and all of that. And I said, oh, wait a second. Let's back up. So, because I had been able to look at the pain in my knees and some other things, hey, if I can sit through my knee melting down, I can probably back up and look at what's going on here. He said, no, it wasn't that bad. Sure, it's bad. I don't want this to happen. But a lot of the stuff that's really bothering me is additional. That's extra. And actually, what I'm kind of upset about is the way that I handled one part of it that I could have done better. Might not have changed anything, but I'm upset about that. I'm also upset about what I think I might feel in a year, given some possible consequence of this. And he says, that's a year from now, and that's how I feel about it. And that's up to me too. So now I still don't like what happened. I'm not happy with the person that helped make it happen that way. But I can get through the day without making, depending on making this person bad so that I feel good and all that. I feel, so I got to back up from it just a little bit and make a better decision about how I handled it and what I did in response to the situation. So now we're getting into the area that the Buddha that the Buddha called clear comprehension here. Because in the sutta, here's where he introduces it. So far he's talked about paying attention to the breath, about graveyard meditations, about paying attention, listening all the parts of the body. There were 31 of them in his count, so that you wouldn't be so tied up with the body, and you could. And then he starts here talking about clear comprehension. Excuse me. He says, a monk, in going forward and in going back, applies clear comprehension. In looking straight on and in looking elsewhere, he applies clear comprehension. In bending and in stretching his limbs, in wearing the robes and carrying the alms bowl, in eating, drinking, chewing, and savoring, in obeying the calls of nature, in walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, speaking, and being silent, he applies clear comprehension. So in all of these things, we're no longer on the pillow. We're no longer here handling what comes at us and handling it skillfully. We're out walking back and forth from here to the linoleum and back for walking meditation. We're eating, or we're talking to somebody, or we're just sitting and listening. And in each of these cases, there's some aspect of volition, our own volition that's being added to it. We're no longer just sitting here with our eyes closed, taking on what comes in, which can be very difficult on its own. We're out in the world dealing with the decisions of others and our own actions. So this is the aspect that is kind of applied mindfulness, the clear comprehension that the Buddha was talking about. And some of it's just straightforward, take what you were doing on the pillow and apply it, say, to walking meditation. So you're walking back and forth. If you're looking for pressure or movement in your abdomen when you were meditating in the breath, is there pressure and movement in your legs as you walk? Part of it's just that simple. I mean, yes, there is, but pay attention to it, and your mind gets more supple, and you notice more things. Are there thoughts when you're on your pillow? You're just wondering when the bell is going to ring. If you're thinking, can you catch the intention to stop, the intention to turn, and the intention to start walking again? Are you aware of the posture of the body when you stand at the end of the walkway? So these are kind of straightforward applications. But then, you know, as you get into, you know, speaking and listening and carrying the alms bowl, going into the village and asking for alms, etc., things get more and more complicated. You never know what's going to come up. And here's where the commentaries break this down into four kinds of clear comprehension. Now, there's the suttas that were written. The teachings of the Buddha were carried, you know, by word of mouth for like 400 or 500 years. And then they're finally written down and continue to be carried on by word of mouth too. But then the Buddha lived 2,500 years ago. And then about 1,500 years ago, a lot of these commentaries started getting written down that had been, some of them had been prepared beforehand. But so listening to the commentaries, they're really good, but it's kind of like reading Thomas Aquinas to find out what Jesus said. So it's a product of 1,000 years of thought, but what they were talking about here is four kinds of clear comprehension. One is the clear comprehension of purpose, clear comprehension of suitability, clear comprehension of the domain of meditation, and the clear comprehension of reality. And the first two of these, I think, really, really apply to us as householders when we're out in the world. And I think the last two have some help for us as well. So the first is the clear comprehension of purpose. And the question there is this action really in accord with our highest goals? And that's easier to say than to do, especially when we're angry or fearful or something like that. But so when I was angry about hurt, angry, afraid, confused—all these things about this happening. I could have said, "I'm going to get that guy." In fact, I did. I just, you know, I was just a little slow getting to my my email or something like that. But I calmed down and I said, no, you know, it's, I've been through this too many times, and you know, what the Buddha said is like getting angry at somebody is like picking up a hot coal and throwing them at it, and throwing it at them. You're always going to burn yourself, and you might miss the other guy with a hot piece of hot coal. And that's what happens. He says, you know, I've been burned too many times by this, so I'm gonna cool it for a bit, see if that happens. So there is a case there, and it stands out because I've done it wrong so many times. But there is a case where I said, oh boy, even though I'd really like to slam this guy, not carrying this thing on and not having my own reactions to worry about next week and next year and all that, that's really more important to me than trying to get back to even in this situation. For example, some of the current affairs, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in the world today and a lot of stuff in our country. We're doing a lot of things that to change the political environment, and maybe for you, maybe not. You say, well, is that really something, you know, the way things are going, do I want, when I look back in this in 20 years, am I going to say, yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to do? Or are you going to say, boy, you know, we're really afraid now, but really strong, but maybe we need to sit back and figure out exactly what it is we want to do in this situation. I don't want to lay that, well, I did, I just did. But that, I mean, I think there's a situation, you know, it's almost, this stuff smacks us in the face all the time. You know, things are moving so fast and things are changing so quickly around us. Can we take the time to step back and say, what do I really want to get done in this situation? Then there's a clear comprehension of suitability. And I summarize that by saying, don't stop applying your values once you've selected your goal. I spent a lot of time in land use politics, which is kind of where environmentalism meets the Board of Supervisors, you know, on the zoning regulations and stuff like that. And I was absolutely sure that what I was doing was the right thing. But then I found out that a lot of some people around me had made exactly that decision and stopped there. That was the last time they applied their values. And then they said, ah, since this is right, anything I do to support this is also right. And I found in some people some of the same personal characteristics I didn't enjoy in some of the people on the other side of the table. In fact, on a personal basis, I got along with some of the real estate developers a lot better than I got along with some of my fellow conservationists. So is what you're doing the right thing? If you have to get angry to get your job done, no matter how good your job is or your cause is that clear comprehension of suitability? For example, maybe our planet's most pressing long-term problem is population. And I think it's right up there. But is abortion the right way? I know people would say both sides. Is abortion an appropriate way to attack that? Or if you think that abortion is absolutely the wrong thing, and you're absolutely sure of that, what's appropriate to do to fight that? We have a Planned Parenthood clinic right across the street. If you come here on, I think, Saturdays, you'll find somebody demonstrating outside and showing very graphic posters. Is that fine? Yeah, probably so. Are bomb threats okay? The reason we can't park in the Planned Parenthood parking lot is because of the bomb threats. Is that okay? Are websites with hit lists okay? Are assassinations okay? I'm not trying to say what the answer is. I'm trying to suggest what a possible question might be. Because it's too easy to say, oh, I believe in this 100%, and then stop applying your values after that. Here's what the Buddha said elsewhere about speech. And I think speech is one of the places where this gets hardest to apply, just because it's so easy to get involved in what's going on. He says, "Monks, a statement endowed with five factors is well spoken, not ill spoken. It is blameless and unfaulted by knowledgeable people. Which five? It is spoken at the right time. It is spoken in truth. It is spoken affectionately. It is spoken beneficially. It is spoken with a mind of goodwill." So, I mean, I don't know if the Buddha would agree with tough love, you know? Or if saying, well, he had it coming, he just had to hear it. I mean, the Buddha didn't seem to be talking about that. And there's this, sometimes I just really want to tell somebody off, or email's a great one. It's so easy to bang something off and send it off to 250 people, and you hit the button and you say, oh gosh, I really shouldn't have done that. And it's so easy to get misinterpreted, and then there it is, not only to 250 people, but it's archived on Google or Deja Vu, and boy, do you feel like a jerk, and you're going to live with that one for a long time. So I think that's clear comprehension of suitability. Then there's a couple others that the Buddha, that the commentaries mention. One is the domain of, clear comprehension of the domain of meditation. And I think that's kind of like a sucker's question, because everything's fair game for meditation, especially if you're doing mindfulness. Sometimes, you know, if you're pulling onto the freeway, you can be mindful, etc. It doesn't mean we can always do that. If we have to put it aside, what the commentaries talked about was setting it down like goods that you're carrying in your hand, with the idea being that when you're done with that, then you don't walk off and leave the groceries there or whatever. You pick them up and take them with you. So you may have to interrupt what you're doing, and there may be times when, oh my gosh, I'm being cut off. You just have to handle it. But you know, if it's appropriate, you can come back. You can come back to the meditation. Maybe you have a time for a few breaths at a stoplight. Something like, maybe that's all you can handle, and that's, or maybe that's more than you were able to handle yesterday, and that's fine too. And then the last one is the clear comprehension of reality. And here the commentators talk about seeing that things are empty and soul, where there's no soul, etc. But I think for me anyway, what I get out of this is, let's step back and make sure that all of this stuff fits within, everything fits, that I'm fitting this within my practice, or it's informed by my practice and supporting my practice. And this is the part I have the hardest time with. Perhaps it's the ability to approach the worldly actions without getting sucked into me and mine. I mean, if you're doing something that's just really, really important, like political action, or if you're a caregiver of some kind, how do you get into that and give fully of it and do something that you think is really important without coming out of it bruised and worn out or cynical or something like that? I mean, I don't have the questions. I don't have the answers. I have a few questions today, but that's where this kind of goes for me, is how do I and get involved fully in the world and yet do so in a way that I protect myself, that I don't cause other people harm, that I don't have to live with the consequences of my own unskillful actions any more than absolutely necessary. And then to kind of close the circle, how can I do that in a way that supports my practice? Because if I'm sitting down, if I do something really stupid tonight, and then when I'm trying to meditate in the morning, if I'm thinking about something, you know, really stupid that I did, I really hurt somebody's feelings or whatever, that's going to interfere with my practice too. And that's where the cycle starts again. Back with sati as bare attention. We practice that that little window of awareness that comes at the very beginning of each perception, and using that as a chance to make a better choice about what we do, whether it's noting the hearing or in, out, or whether it's deciding, just we're going to wait, let the person explain just a little bit more before we tell them how confused they are, or go to the water cooler before you send that email, or think real hard about whether your involvement in your particular political cause or something is turning you into the kind of person you want to be, or if you feel that it's okay to trade off some of your personal qualities for the good of this greater goal, whatever it is, this election or this piece of political action or whatever. So that's what I had to say, and I hadn't intended to talk this long because I wanted to hear what you guys have to say. If there are questions, I'll try and answer questions, but I'm also, this is one of the few times venues we have just to talk amongst ourselves, and I want to encourage that too, if you have observations or something like that. So let's go on. If there are any questions or observations, and feel free to answer somebody from across the room, let's just go on with that, and then we'll, for 10 minutes, and then I'd like to meditate for a few minutes, and then we'll close at 9, okay? If you don't have any, I'll make you do the Pali. Always takes a minute, about a minute before somebody says, oh, nobody else can ask a question, I'll ask mine. How many of you had heard or seen Pali before tonight? I'm just curious. A few, okay, that's a lot. Okay. So Pali was the... was a language related to the language that the Buddha spoke, and it was kind of like Italian was to Latin. So it's kind of like demotic Latin, demotic Sanskrit. A lot of the words are the same. We say Dhamma. In Sanskrit, they say Dharma. We say Nibbana. In Sanskrit, they say Nirvana. So that's why some of the words sounded funny tonight. We can meditate then. Let's for another 15 minutes, let's just sit.